7. Getting started with 80-20 running. I have a confession to make. The 80-20 rule is not quite as simple as I've made it out to be. There is some fine print that you need to understand before you can practice 80-20 running effectively. Here's another confession. The 80-20 rule is not the only rule you must follow to get the most out of your training. If all you knew about how to train was that you should do 80% of your running at low intensity and 20% at moderate and high intensities, you would be left with far too much leeway to make all kinds of other mistakes. For example, the 80-20 rule says nothing about how to structure the different types of runs or about the proper way to sequence workouts to create a progressive training program. The 80-20 rule alone doesn't suffice to guarantee a successful training. Maximizing the results you will get from all of the time and energy you invest in your training will require that you practice the 80-20 rule in conjunction with several other rules that coaches and runners have also learned through many decades of trial and error, and that, alongside the 80-20 rule, are almost universally practiced by elite runners today. In this chapter, I will explain the nuances of the 80-20 rule and describe 6 additional rules that work synergistically with it to make the training process as effective as it can possibly be. Once you understand these rules and how they fit together, you will know everything you need to know to realize your full potential as a runner. Rule number 1, the 80-20 rule, the fine print. The basic formula of the 80-20 rule is this. Do 80% of your training at low intensity and 20% at moderate and high intensities. The complete, fine print and all formulation of the same rule is this. Do approximately 80% of your training at low intensity and 20% at moderate and high intensities, except during specific periods of training when it is beneficial to do somewhat more or somewhat less low intensity training. And unless you learn through experience that you benefit from slightly greater or slightly lesser amounts of low-intensity running, and be sure to vary the bounds of moderate and high-intensity training in your program based on the sort of race you're preparing for. That's a mouthful, I know, but as I spell it all out, you will find the underlying concepts easy enough to grasp. When Stephen Saylor defined and named the 80-20 rule, he was making an approximation. His research had shown him that elite athletes in several endurance sports did about 80% of their training at low intensity and roughly 20% at moderate and high intensities. No athlete, however, maintains a precise 80-20 balance all the time or even tries to. And even if an athlete did aim for such precision, it would be exceedingly difficult to pull off. What's more, even if an athlete did manage to maintain a precise 80-20 balance, it wouldn't matter much. There is a general understanding among coaches, athletes, and exercise scientists that small variations in training produce no measurable differences in fitness and performance. Training is a bit like diet in this regard. You do not eat the same amount of food every day. There are day-to-day fluctuations of a few dozen calories, sometimes more, in your food intake. Yet your weight holds fairly steady from week to week. Similarly, if the ratio of your training time spent at low intensity and above low intensity averages out to 78-22 or 82-18 instead of 80-20 on the dot over a period of time, your race results will probably be the same in either case. There's no reason to tie yourself in knots trying to aim for perfectly round numbers. What is important is that you avoid ratios that are way off the mark, such as 100-0, 30-70, and the 50-50 ratio that is the norm for recreational runners. In short, the ideal balance of training intensities is a narrow range rather than a precise ratio. But that range may be slightly different for individual runners. The 80-20 rule is what Saylor has referred to as the population optimum. This means that a training intensity distribution that is very close to 80-20 is best for most, but not all runners. A few runners respond better if they do a little less or a little more of their training at low intensity. There is no evidence, however, of extreme outliers who respond poorly to 80-20 training and much better to either a heavily speed-based program or to an always slow regimen that lacks any work at higher intensities. So you can't go wrong by following the 80-20 rule. It's certainly the place to start. As you gain experience, though, you may find that you respond better to a 70-30 ratio or a 90-10 ratio, in which case you'll want to make that your personal rule. But it's more likely that you will find your sweet spot closer to 80-20. The sweet spot shifts, however, as the training process moves along. The art of sequencing runs of different types into a progressive program that culminates in peak fitness for one or more races is called periodization. Most elite runners use a phased approach to periodization, where certain types of workouts tend to be clustered into a particular period for the sake of achieving a specific fitness objective that is appropriate for that time. Some of these objectives may require that a runner do either more or less than 80% of his or her running at low intensity. The training process starts with the base phase. The primary objective of this phase is to gradually increase running mileage to a target level that is appropriate for the individual runner. In this case, it is generally best to do more than 80% of training at low intensity, because it's both easier and less risky to increase running mileage when faster running is kept to a modicum. It is important to include some faster running in the base phase, though, because it prepares the body for the harder workouts of the peak phase, when the 80-20 rule goes into effect. The last part of the training process, which comes after the peak phase, is called the taper. The taper period immediately precedes an important race. The objective of this 1 to 2 week mini phase is to rest and prime the body for racing. Research and real-world practice have shown that the best way to achieve this objective is to sharply reduce the overall training volume while continuing to do high-intensity workouts. The contribution of low-intensity running to a well-executed taper may therefore be somewhat less than 80%. The proper balance of moderate intensity and high-intensity training also varies by circumstance. Steven Saylor and his fellow researchers have not found consistent enough evidence to proclaim that one particular way of balancing moderate intensity and high-intensity training is clearly optimal. On the one hand, they have found that elite athletes tend to do more training at high intensity than they do at moderate intensity. And as we heard in Chapter 3, some intriguing studies have demonstrated that endurance athletes get great results from a polarized training approach where they do 80% of their training at low intensity, 20% at high intensity, and none at moderate intensity. On the other hand, the most impressive results obtained so far in any study of the effects of 80-20 training on runners were seen in runners who did roughly equal amounts of moderate and high-intensity training. There is also evidence that athletes get more out of moderate-intensity training than they do out of high-intensity training when preparing for longer events. While the scientists continue to explore these questions, I believe it's best for runners to follow the current best practices of top coaches by balancing moderate intensity and high intensity training situationally. For example, if you're training for a 5K, you should probably do more high intensity training because 5Ks are typically raced at high intensity. But if you're training for a marathon, you should probably do more moderate intensity running because it is more specific to the actual demands of marathon racing. Rule number 2, train in cycles. What would happen if you tried to increase your running fitness every week for as long as you possibly could? Assuming you proceeded in a sensible way, increasing your training load very slowly and giving your body regular opportunities to recover, you would make consistent progress for up to 24 weeks. Then you would hit a wall. At that point, any further increases in your training load would yield no further gains in fitness and instead would only leave you more and more fatigued. Eventually, if you did not get injured first, you would develop a severe case of chronic fatigue known as overtraining syndrome, and you would be forced to stop running altogether. The human body is not able to absorb increasing training loads for longer than about 24 weeks at a stretch. For this reason, runners need to train in cycles. Each training cycle must be followed by a recuperative period lasting at least a couple of weeks. Despite losing some fitness during such breaks, you will be able to start the next cycle at a higher level of base fitness than you did the last one, and therefore, you'll also be able to train harder and attain a higher level of peak fitness. Training cycles may be shorter than 24 weeks. The optimal duration is determined by your initial fitness level and by the distance of your peak race. If your peak race is long, such as a marathon, and your initial fitness level is fairly low, you should allow close to 24 weeks to prepare. If your peak race is short, such as a 5K, and your initial fitness level is fairly high, you may need as little as 6 weeks to attain peak fitness for that distance. Rule number 3, run more, little by little. The most effective way to improve as a runner, as you already know, is to follow the 80-20 rule. The second most effective way to improve is to run more. Once you have corrected the intensity balance in your training, consider increasing your running volume. If currently you only run 3 or 4 times per week, set a goal to run 6 or 7 times per week. According to the World Health Organization, daily aerobic exercise is required for maximum all-around health. As a runner, you might as well meet this requirement by running. Not only will your health improve, but your running will too. Once you're consistently running 6 or 7 times per week, a sensible next step is to increase the average duration of your runs to 1 hour. When you reach that point, you'll be running a total of 6 or 7 hours per week. You can cover a lot of ground in 6 or 7 hours. If your average pace is 10 minutes per mile, you'll run 42 miles in a 7-hour training week. By running longer 1 day per week, you can get your total weekly running volume closer to 50 miles. Take your time building your running volume. The body's tolerance for the stress of running increases slowly. It's best to err on the side of caution and proceed even slower than you think you could. Aim to boost your average weekly running volume by no more than 10 miles from year to year. Even at this cautious rate, you can go from 20 miles per week to 60 miles per week in 4 years. Each runner has a personal running volume limit, which is usually greater than the runner's current limit. If your ultimate goal is to become the best runner you can possibly be, then you'll want to continue to increase your running volume until your current limit merges with your final genetic limit. This is the point beyond which there is no possibility for further improvement by means of additional running. Typically, it takes many years of cautious and consistent development for a runner to reach this limit, which again is different for each of us. Outside of the elite ranks, few runners discover their personal maximum running volume. Running just isn't important enough for most recreational runners to make that kind of commitment. Each runner must decide how much time and effort he's willing to commit toward improvement. I am not going to badger you into running more than you want to, but I would like to persuade you to want to run more than you do today. And if I can't do that, then at the very least, I would like you to recognize that running more is always available to you as your best option for improvement once you're following the 80-20 rule. If you don't care to run more now, you can always change your mind at some point in the future. Besides the matter of willingness, a separate impediment to running more is fear of injury. In Chapter 12, I will show you how to work around this issue by using cross-training as an alternative to running more. Rule number 4. Do tried and true workouts. There are several distinct types of runs that are practiced almost universally by elite runners. Like the 80-20 rule, these workouts emerged as best practices through decades of collective trial and error. Non-elite runners rarely include all of these workouts in their training. Adding any missing workout types to your program and practicing each type correctly will help you follow the 80-20 rule more faithfully and get better results from your training. I briefly mentioned the various types of runs in Chapter 6. I will now describe them in more detail and present a full spectrum of formats for each. You can draw upon these workout menus to create 80-20 running plans for yourself. To show you how it's done, I've used these same menus to create the training plans that are offered in Chapters 8 through 11. Refer to your PDF companion to view these plans. There are a dozen types of run in all. They are divided into three categories. Low-intensity runs take place entirely in Zones 1 and 2. Refer to Table 6.2 for zone descriptions. Moderate-intensity runs include at least one segment in Zone 3. High-intensity runs feature multiple efforts in Zone 4 or 5 or both. The intensity breakdown information given in the right-hand column of each table in the PDF companion will help you balance your training appropriately when you create training programs from these menus. When selecting the workout types and levels to include in a given week, tally up the total time spent at low intensity and the total time spent at all intensities, and divide the former by the latter to see how close the result comes to 0.8, or 80%. If it's not close enough, make an adjustment. Note that in the case of interval-type workouts that feature relatively short active recovery periods between high-intensity efforts, the entire interval section of the workout, including recovery periods, is counted as time spent at high intensity. Steven Saylor has argued that this method best reflects the actual stressfulness and training effect of this type of workout. Low-intensity runs. Recovery runs, foundation runs, and long runs include efforts in zones 1 and 2 only. Recovery runs. A recovery run is a run undertaken entirely in zone 1. These runs are intended to be done as the next run after a very challenging workout. Often, an alternative to taking a day off, they serve to increase running volume in a gentle way that does not interfere with recovery from recent hard training. Foundation runs. A foundation run is a steady, low-intensity run of short to moderate duration. It begins with a warm-up in Zone 1, then moves to Zone 2 for a while, and concludes with a cool-down back in Zone 1. Foundation runs are the bread and butter of effective 80-20 training, the workout type you'll rely on more than any other to ensure you're doing enough running at low intensity. Long runs. A long run is simply an extended foundation run that is measured in distance instead of time. Somewhat arbitrarily, I place the minimum long run distance at 6 miles. With most workouts, time is a better way to give runners of different abilities an equal challenge. For example, if I tell two runners to run 5 miles, and one runs 10-minute miles and the other runs 6-minute miles, the slow runner is going to be out there for almost an hour, while the fast runner is only going to get a half hour of training. It's better to give everyone a time and let the faster runner cover more distance in that time. But long runs are different, because their job is to build the endurance needed to cover a particular race distance. So long runs really need to be prescribed in distance to give every runner equal preparation to go the distance in their race. Moderate intensity runs. Fast finish runs, tempo runs, long runs with speed play, and long runs with fast finish include efforts in Zone 3. Fast finish runs. A fast finish run tacks a relatively short effort in Zone 3 onto the end of a foundation run. Fast finish runs are particularly useful as a way to infuse a little moderate intensity running into your training during the base phase, when your focus is on increasing volume, and during recovery weeks, when you may want just a maintenance dose of moderate intensity work. Tempo runs. A tempo run is a sustained effort in Zone 3, sandwiched between a warm-up and a cool-down. Tempo runs are a very effective means of enhancing a runner's ability to sustain relatively aggressive speeds. They are emphasized in the peak phase of training for races of all distances from 5K to the marathon. Cruise interval runs. A cruise interval run features multiple long intervals in Zone 3, separated by Zone 1 recoveries. These runs offer essentially the same benefit as tempo runs, but because the Zone 3 running is divided up, they allow more total work to be done at moderate intensity. Long runs with speed play. A long run with speed play is an endurance run that's done mostly at low intensity, but has short bursts in Zone 3 sprinkled throughout it. Long runs with speed play are good workouts to do late in a training cycle when you've already built the basic endurance you need to achieve your peak race goal, i.e. when you've already done the longest run you intend to do. The addition of Zone 3 efforts serves to increase fatigue resistance beyond the extent that can be accomplished through long runs done entirely at low intensity. Like other types of long runs with speed play are measured in distance instead of time. Long runs with fast finish. A long run with fast finish is an extended run at low intensity with a relatively short effort at moderate intensity tacked on to the end. Like long runs with speed play, long runs with fast finish serve to further increase fatigue resistance toward the end of a training cycle after you've already developed basic endurance to go the distance in your next race. These workouts are also measured in distance. High-intensity runs. Speed play runs, hill repetition runs, and interval runs featuring long, short, and mixed intervals include high-intensity efforts in zones 4 and 5. Speed play runs. A speed play run is a cross between a foundation run and an interval run. Like foundation runs, speed play runs are done mostly in zone 2. But this low-intensity backdrop is punctuated by short bursts at high intensity, as in interval runs. Speed play runs are generally intended to be somewhat easier than interval runs, though, and are traditionally done on trails or roads instead of at the track. They are used most often as a low-key way to include some high-intensity running in the base phase of training, when increasing the overall volume of running is the top priority. They also offer a nice break from interval runs in recovery weeks. Hill repetition runs. A hill repetition run is essentially an uphill interval run, featuring short segments of uphill running in Zone 5. Hill repetitions offer many of the same benefits as interval runs, namely increased aerobic capacity and high-intensity fatigue resistance, as well as improved running economy. But hill repetitions are less stressful on the legs because impact forces are much lower on an upward slope. For this reason, hill repetition runs make a good bridge between base training and peak training. Short interval runs. A short interval run features repeated efforts of 60 to 90 seconds in Zone 5, separated by jogging recoveries in Zone 1. Short intervals enhance aerobic capacity, high-intensity fatigue resistance, and running economy. Long interval runs. A long interval run features repeated efforts of 3 to 5 minutes in Zone 4. Long interval runs maximize high-intensity fatigue resistance. Mixed interval runs. Mixed interval runs are intended to sharpen runners up for racing after they've already built a solid foundation of fitness. Including efforts in zones 3, 4, and 5, they serve to maintain the fitness gains that have been accrued through workouts individually focused on each of these zones. Rule number 5. Obey the hard, easy principle. The so-called hard, easy principle was developed by University of Oregon coaches Bill Dellinger and Bill Bowerman. This principle states that the hardest runs in a runner's program should not be bunched together, but instead should be separated by lighter workouts. It's another one of those practices that makes so much intuitive sense, it's a wonder anyone had to discover it. In any case, the hard, easy principle is now practiced universally by elite runners who use it to organize their standard weekly workout schedules. Also known as microcycles, these recurring 7-day workout schedules typically include 3 designated hard days, which are buffered on either side by at least 1 day of lighter training. 2 of the 3 hard days feature moderate intensity or high intensity runs, while the 3rd is reserved for a longer run, which is done mostly or entirely at low intensity. Here is the microcycle template that I employ most often when coaching runners. It is used in all of the training plans in chapters 9 to 12. Monday, easy run or rest. Tuesday, moderate or high intensity run. Wednesday, easy run. Thursday, easy run. Friday, moderate or high intensity run. Saturday, easy run. Sunday, long run. Rule number 6. Practice step cycles. Step cycles take the hard, easy principle to a broader time scale. Also known as mesocycles, step cycles are multi-week training blocks in which the running workload is intentionally varied from week to week. In a step cycle, each week of training is slightly more challenging than the preceding, until the last week of the cycle, when the training load is reduced to promote recovery and prepare the body for another round of harder training. Typically, these adjustments are achieved by increasing and decreasing overall running volume, rather than by fiddling with the balance of intensities. For example, if your hardest week of training in a given step cycle features 38 total miles of running and an 80-20 intensity balance, then the subsequent recovery week should feature, say, 31 miles of total running and an 80-20 intensity balance, instead of something like 38 total miles and a 90-10 intensity balance. 3-week and 4-week step cycles are practiced most commonly. 4-week cycles typically work well for low-mileage runners who don't build up a lot of fatigue. 3-week cycles are often better for runners who push their limits in training and for older runners who need more rest. The shorter cycles are the safer option generally because they offer more frequent opportunities to catch up on recovery. All of the training plans in chapters 9 to 12 feature 3-week step cycles. Here are examples of how the overall volume of running might be varied in 3-week and 4-week step cycles. 3-week step cycle. Week 1, 20 miles. Week 2, 24 miles. Week 3, 16 miles. 4-week step cycle. Week 1, 60 miles. Week 2, 64 miles. Week 3, 68 miles. Week 4, 50 miles. Rule number 7. Train progressively. The most important characteristic of a training program is its direction. A well-designed training program should move you closer and closer to a state of peak race readiness as it goes along. In other words, it should be progressive. One way to make the training process progressive is to make it incrementally harder, that is, to increase the overall training load that it administers step by step. I've said plenty about this method already. A second way to make the training process progressive is to make your hard workouts more and more race-specific. A short race such as a 5K demands a slightly different kind of fitness than does a longer race such as a half marathon. If you want to run your best 5K, the peak phase of your training program needs to culminate in some challenging runs that are done at or near 5K race intensity. Likewise, to run your best half marathon, you need to sharpen up for it with a few workouts that closely simulate the endurance and intensity demands of that specific distance. One of the key objectives of the early part of the peak phase of training is to get your body ready to handle these race-specific workouts by doing workouts that are somewhat less race-specific. In turn, this period of training should be preceded by a period of general conditioning, or base training, that is more or less the same for all race distances. That's all there is to it. You now know everything you need to know to design and execute your own 80-20 running program. If you're not quite ready to take that step, you may want to begin by following one of the training plans in chapters 8 through 11, and which are available in your PDF companion. You can then use these plans as templates for constructing your own fully customized plans.